morning. I'm glad you're here. My name is Elliot. I'm the pastor here, and thank you for prioritizing Jesus over a vacation and being here. Kidding. But welcome. It should probably be noted that many of us are several of our people are gone and traveling this weekend, which is great. It's a great weekend to visit our church because a lot of people are out of town. But it's also a little lighter in here because something we've been working on and laboring towards and putting a lot of prayer, energy, work towards is launching a fourth Sunday service, a third Sunday morning service at Waverly Belmont Elementary, which is like less than a block away right down Carruthers right here. They actually did, that team did a secret service this morning, like a soft launch, friends and family only. And I snuck down early this morning and helped them unload. I carried all the heaviest stuff, but then I snuck down in between services just kind of see how it was going, and it was really beautiful. And so you'll continue to hear about that service, that it is where we believe the Lord is leading us to help make Sunday mornings a little less crowded and a little more hospitable in this room. It's also a chance to follow Jesus where he's leading. It doesn't always give us the answers. It says, hey, we follow where I'm asking you to go. And so they will begin that service officially every Sunday in two Sundays, Sunday the 15th. Today was kind of a soft launch, and then on September 15th, they will start at 10 a.m. down the street. So if you've got questions about that, if you want to help volunteer at it, because they need kind of a semester-long launch team to help with setup and teardown in Kidtown, they need all that. So please stay eager and stay curious about how that's going, and take friends with you if you want to go down and check it out Sundays at 10. On that note, if we have your mailing address, you got a postcard from us this week, and we don't ever send postcards, and that was kind of the point, that you would notice, take note of, oh, wow, I got a postcard from my church because they're ancient. There's something really exciting in addition to the Waverly Belmont service that kind of has to do with our home and place on this corner that we're going to talk about next Sunday. Not during the service, but we'll kind of cut the service short and talk about it in the last 15 or 20 minutes of next Sunday service. We'll let you into some really exciting things that we believe the Lord is leading us into as well as far as our home on this corner. So I'm being intentionally vague so that you come back next Sunday and come hear what it's about. Now we dive into week three of the book of Judges. We began a sermon series a couple weeks ago on the book of Judges. Thesis statement for the book of Judges, overall theme of the book of Judges, is this one verse that is the conclusion verse of the whole book of Judges. It's also repeated throughout the book of Judges, but it's a punch. It does not mince words. Here is the state of things in the land of Israel during the book of Judges, is the last verse in the whole book. In those days, Israel had no king, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. So a whole nation who's been led out of Egypt in slavery, led through the Red Sea by Moses, through the wilderness, getting to the promised land. Joshua leads them into the promised land. They're supposed to settle into the promised land, and they fail to do that because in those days, Israel had no king, and everyone did what was right in their own eyes. That's the state of things in Judges. It has been noted that the Judges storyline repeats the same cycle, and so there's this downward spiral in the book of Judges. That's what we looked at the last couple of weeks is, how does this book start in the settling of the promised land and then get into a train wreck really quickly that lasts about 200 years of them continuing to do their own way and then continuing to be in the same kind of hurricane spiral and cycle? So we've looked at the intro of all that the last couple weeks. Today we begin the hurricane. Today is the first story, the first judge we'll look at, the first deliverer that God raises up in this book, but it's only spiraling out kind of week in and week out. So here we go. Othniel is the first judge mentioned in chapter 3. This is when the cycle begins. And then we skip over Othniel. He's got about 7 or 8 verses. And now we get to Ehud. And if there's kids in the room, they're welcome to stay. This is, I don't know if it's R, maybe PG-13, I don't know. Definitely, you've probably not seen this in a movie, okay? But it's grotesque. It is, it's something. So kids, stay at your own risk, okay? Parents, leave them in. Let them grow up a little bit, okay? Here we go. Judges, Judges chapter 3, starting in verse 12. I promise you, if you've never read the book of Judges, you will not believe that a story like this is in the Bible, okay? And the people, this is verse 12. And the people of Israel, this is the telling you about the cycle. The people of Israel again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord. And the Lord strengthened Eglon, the king of Moab, against Israel. That's interesting. Because they had done what was evil in the sight of the Lord. He gathered to himself, this is Eglon, the enemy king, the Ammonites and the Amalekites, he's getting allies, and went and defeated Israel. They took possession of the city of palms. And the people of Israel served Eglon, the king of Moab, 18 years, like indentured in bondage to him. Then the people of Israel cried out to the Lord, and the Lord raised up for them a deliverer, a judge, Ehud, the son of Gera, the Benjaminite, a left-handed man. The people of Israel sent tribute by him, that's by Ehud, their judge, their deliverer, to Eglon. They're sending tribute offering to the king of Moab. And Ehud made for himself a sword with two edges, a cubit in length, that's about a foot and a half. And he bound it on his right thigh under his clothes, because he's left-handed, that's where he needs to pull it from. And he presented the tribute to Eglon, king of Moab. Now, Eglon was a very fat man. Let's pray. No, I'm kidding. And when Ehud had finished presenting the tribute, he sent away the people who carried the tribute with him, like his team. But he himself turned back at the idols near Gilgal, kind of outside of, out of town, and said, I have a secret message for you, O king. And this is the king speaking, Eglon. And he commanded silence. And all his attendants went out from his presence. And Ehud came to him as he was sitting alone in his cool roof chamber. And Ehud said, I have a message from God for you. And he arose from his seat, and Ehud reached with his left hand, took out the sword from his right thigh, and thrust it into his belly. And the hilt, that's the handle, also went in after the blade, and the fat closed over the blade. For he did not pull the sword out of his belly, and the dung came out. What? Then Ehud went into the porch and closed the doors of the roof chamber behind him and locked them. When he had gone, the servants came, and when they saw that the doors of the roof chamber were locked, they thought, surely he is relieving himself. He's going to the bathroom in the closet of the cool chamber. And they waited till they were embarrassed. How long do you think that was? But when he still did not open the doors of the roof chamber, they took the key and opened them, and there lay their Lord dead on the floor. Ehud escaped while they delayed, and he passed beyond the idols and escaped to Syrah. When he arrived, he sounded the trumpet in the hill country of Ephraim. Then the people of Israel went down with him from the hill country, and he was their leader. And he said to them, follow after me, for the Lord has given your enemies, the Moabites, into your hand. So they went down after him and seized the fords of the Jordan against the Moabites and did not allow anyone to pass over. And they killed them, at that time about 10,000 of the Moabites, all strong, able-bodied men, not a man escaped. So Moab was subdued that day under the hand of Israel, and the land had rest for 80 years. Okay. This is the word of the Lord, I think. No, it is. Why is this in Scripture? Because here's what every commentator would tell you. This is like an ancient world form of satire. It's a real story. Like, it's written in a historical narrative. The narrator is narrating for us actual events. But it's there's irony, there's satire. It's like an ancient cartoon that actually happened. It's like all the details were given, all the angles of why does he include that part, and we're going to try to unpack all this. But many commentators would say, like, this is a story unlike almost anything else in the Bible. Not just what happened, but, like, the way we're told about it and how the narrator presents it to us. So what's going on? Well, the scene is set in verses 12 through 14, kind of gets us to the meat of the passage. This is what we need to see kind of as the context for this kingly assassination. Look at verse 12 through 14. It says, and the people of Israel, again, this is the cycle of judges, again did what was evil in the sight of the Lord, and the Lord strengthened Eglon, the king of Moab, against Israel. Isn't that interesting? Because they had done what was evil in the sight of the Lord. He gathered to himself, that's King Eglon of Moab, the Ammonites and the Amalekites, and went and defeated Israel, and they took possession of the city of palms, and the people of Israel served Eglon, the king of Moab, 18 years. Okay, so the two main kind of perpetrators against God's people, Moab, this land, this people group kind of southeast of Israel, had been longtime enemies of God's people. They had attacked Moses in the wilderness when he was trying to lead them from the Red Sea to the Promised Land. They had attacked them. Their name, Moab, the Moabites, means the fatherless ones, the fatherless nation, which is kind of like it's throwing shade at them. Like they don't even have fathers. Like they are a scattered people. They're not together. They're a fatherless people. And then Eglon, their king, is presented to us as a total buffoon. His name literally means, so the fatherless people has a king whose name literally means the fat cow. That's what his name means. So the image, Star Wars fans, is Jabba the Hutt. That's who we've got here, okay? He's a morose, obese, angry, glutton king sitting on his throne and he's presented that way. No one likes him in the story. He was not a beloved king. And together, the Moabites, the fatherless ones, and Eglon, the fat cow, these two entities, they get allies, and they come and attack and oppress and enslave Israel for 18 years. And what we're told about them in their battles against Israel, it's a key victory that we're told about from the enemies. They take the City of Palms, which is a huge high school basketball tournament in Fort Myers. That's not what we're talking about. It is actually the same city as Jericho. Jericho is known as the City of Palms. So, okay, reader, ancient Israelite student, if the people against God, if the Moabites and Eglon, if the fat cow king over the fatherless ones just took Jericho, what dots is this connecting? Well, Jericho, Joshua in the battle of, was the first city taken by the Israelites when they crossed the Jordan River into the Promised Land to begin to settle it. It was the first sign, the taking of the Battle of Jericho with Rahab and the walking around the city, if you've heard that story. It's the first sign that God was actually going to give them the Promised Land. It was the first sign, the first taking of a city that the Israelites knew God is on our side and he is going to give us this Promised Land. And now, a couple generations later, it's been taken from them. Okay, so wait. Is this reversing the blessing? Is Moab and Eglon, are they reversing the blessing of God giving the Promised Land to his people? Is everything about to come unraveled? Is everything about to come unglued? He gave us the Promised Land that started with Jericho. Now we've lost Jericho to the fatherless ones with a fat cow king. Okay? Now, here's please remember this. All throughout the book of Judges. The book of Judges was not written to throw shade at or make fun of the enemies of God's people. Kind of seems like it in this story with all like the poking fun at these people and their king. The book of Judges was written as an indictment against the people of God when they decided to become their own kings. And so the point of this passage is not to go, man, look at how funny and idiotic and cartoonish their enemies are. The point is, yeah, in Israel, those people are now ruling over you. The fat king is ruling over you. That's how bad it's gotten. The fat cow with the fatherless nation, they are now your enslavers. This is an indictment against the people of God. It's not making fun of the enemies. It's making fun, it's poking at the people of God. And so in that state, they're being ruled over by an oppressive enemy, Jabba the Hutt ruler. In that state, after 18 years of misery, of being ruled, the people of Jericho and people around Jericho, being ruled over by this idiotic king, they cry out. Now in the book of Judges, when they cry out, they're not repenting. They're not actually sorry for what they've done. They want relief. They're in misery. So Lord, come do something, and like, this is kind of not fun anymore. Like, come help us and do something. Didn't you promise to give us this land? You gave, like, come help us. They want relief, not restored relationship with the Lord. So they cry out to him, come save us. And he does. Verse 15, then the people of Israel cried out to the Lord, and the Lord raised up for them a deliverer, Ehud, the son of Gera, the Benjaminite, a left-handed man. Ehud's name literally means, where is the majesty? Which is a great question for the nation. A non-ironic name for this deliverer, this judge to be raised up. That is the question to Israel. Where is your glory? Where is your majesty? Look at what has become of you in the days where there is no king and everyone's doing what's right in their own eyes. We're also told here that Ehud is a left-handed man. That is not a red herring. That is not unnecessary information. Anytime in the Bible you're told about a physical description of someone, lean in and listen in. Why is the narrator telling us that? Well, he's left-handed, which in the ancient world would have been seen as like unnatural, and what good could a southpaw do? Like, he wasn't a pitcher. Like, what's going to help? How could a left-handed man help us? What's he going to do? And then to throw more irony on the situation, he's a Benjaminite, which Benjamin literally means son of the right hand. and they were known as warriors. So from this tribe of right-handed warriors, we have this left-handed man. So what's coming out of the page is, okay, God, thanks for raising up Ehud. He's not gonna be able to do anything. He's a left-handed man from the right-handed tribe. Like, this is not gonna help us. The irony is jumping off, again, to the reader. What good could Ehud do? Now, we don't know why was he left-handed. And there's a bunch of theories about it. Scholars and commentators argue about, like, textual proof from other passages and what it meant for him. Maybe he was deformed in his right hand and he had to use his left hand, so he was already an outcast. Maybe. Probably not. Maybe what it means is he actually trained by the Lord and, like, raised to be a mercenary, trained himself in his warrior training by tying up his right hand and becoming ambidextrous. Like, I know one day I'm going to need my left hand, so I'm going to become skilled with my left hand, and no one will know. Either way, this is an unlikely person to raise up. So how could the Lord use this person? And then, for about 15 verses, we get an extremely detailed account of his espionage, of his, sometimes like too much detail, of his assassination of the king of Moab. So to recap, these 15 or so verses, here's what happens. Ehud is raised up, this left-handed warrior from the right-handed tribe. Who is this? Could he do anything? He is sent with the tribute team to go to Eglon to bring a tribute offering, to try to make peace. Like, hey, don't keep attacking our promised land. Kind of stay put. We want peace with you. Could have been animals, could have been money. Some kind of tribute offering is made to Eglon, the king, Jabba. And for some reason, he kind of takes to Ehud. He kind of likes him. And they're on their way back. They drop the offering off, and Ehud's had this plan the whole time. As a left-handed warrior, he has tucked a handmade dagger into his right thigh where he could grab it. He sends the tribute people on back to their hometown. He turns back on the edges of Jericho and goes, I'm gonna go back to the king. I got something for him. Y'all go on. I'm going to go back myself. He comes back. The guards let him through. The guards let an enemy through who was just in the room. They let him back. He says, I have a secret message for Eglon. Eglon buys it, says, okay, clears the room. Hey, guards, you need to leave the room because this man, who's an enemy, has a secret message for me. Let him through. Come in, kicks all the guards out of the chambers. Eglon, Jabba, is now left in his chambers with Ehud. Ehud closes the door behind him and says, I have a secret message for you. It's called my knife. And then he pulls his dagger out of his right thigh, right, which would have been not expected, stabs Eglon in, now again, this is like an 18-inch, that's sort of a cubit. It's an 18-inch, like elbow to the tip of your fingers. This 18-inch shiv into Eglon, Jabba, and the fat eats the blade and handle. So much so, like he can't even get it out. It goes all the way in, and it pushes the dung out. Like perfectly straight. No, what that probably means is that he lost all bowel controls, which happens in that kind of like trauma moment. And he's like laying in his own feces. That's in there. I didn't make that up. And then the guards smell it. We're told that. And they think he must be relieving himself. He must be going to the bathroom. We'll leave him in there longer with this enemy of ours. Gives time for Ehud to close the door, lock the roof chamber, jump down, get away scot-free. The guards wait until they are embarrassed. Again, like, I don't know how long that is. Is that 30 seconds or 30 minutes? I don't know. But it smelt so bad that they thought, he needs our help in there. We've got to go in and get him. And so they go in and they use their key and open up, and their king is dead on the floor while Ehud is scot-free, rallying the troops to bring them back to slaughter all the Moabites in the city of palms and restore the land to the owners of Israel. That's the story. That's what we just read. And what you have to note, and especially as we read Judges, you'll see this, maybe more than any other Judges story that we'll see, we're given some very particular detail here. Like all these commentators note, like it's very interesting how much to what lengths the author goes to tell us details of the story that are seemingly unnecessary. Like, why are we told? It could, like, if you read the next judge's story, literally, at the end of this chapter, is one sentence. This judge killed 600 men with an ox goad and restored Israel. Like, you can say it real brief, but we're given a ton of detail, almost unnecessary detail, so much so that every commentator points this out. and notes this. In the story, if you read the story of Ehud, like we just did, if you go looking for the Lord in the story, he may be tough to find. The Lord's only mentioned twice in the story. The first verse, verse 12, and here's what we're told in verse 12. He's mentioned, but what's he said to be doing? He's giving strength to the enemies. It's the only time the Lord has ever done that. In the book of Judges, the only time we will note that he is strengthening the enemies of God. So that's verse 12. So the Lord is mentioned, but it's not good. And then he's not mentioned till the very, very end of the story, verse 28, where Ehud, it's like a rallying cry, like the Lord is going to give us victory today. That's it. The Lord never speaks himself. The Lord never does anything. The Lord's not said to be doing anything in the story of Ehud. And yet, we are given an incredible amount of detail, so much so that for the narrator to tell us all these details and not mention the Lord at all is really interesting. Because as the episode unfolds and Ehud kills Eglon and then leads them against the Moabites, you could get to the end of the story and go, wait, there's no mention of the Lord here at all. And so jumping off the page to the reader is the very apparent silence of God. He's only mentioned two times, and one of those times he's mentioned to be strengthening the enemy fighting against the Israelites. And so for like 18 verses, the Lord is not mentioned. And so essentially every commentator notes this, like it's really unique that in that many verses with that much detail, there would be no mention of the Lord. So he's not mentioned, and yet, this is the point, there are so many details given in the story that the Lord is so clearly at work in the story, but he's actually not mentioned. So we have this like paradox. The details of the story are far too circumstantial to not be providential. That's what's happening. God is not mentioned at all, and yet he's in every detail. Like, think about all these details. Like, play this out, and you tell me if you think this, the details that the story unfolds are possible without the Lord being involved in the details. One, we have a uniquely left-handed man from the right-handed tribe, which means he's actually able to conceal a weapon over on this side, so no one else would have been able to conceal a weapon, which helps him with the guards, because if the guards are checking for weapons as they go into the king's chambers, they're going to look over here where all the right-handed warriors from Benjamin carry their swords. Not Ehud. He's carrying it over here. That's interesting. And then, this is kind of comical, Ehud gets time with the king in the king's chamber with a really weak spy reason to get time with him. I have a secret message for you. Like, when has a king or the guard said, oh, you have a secret for the king. Please come and tell him what your secret is. Like, it's a terrible reason to get past the guards, but it works. And then, after the really weak reason to get alone with the king decides to clear the room. Hey, guards, leave me alone with this enemy who has a secret message for me. Like, what is happening? Why is the king clearing his room? And then, and this is where, like, the details, how is this even possible that this would happen? The killing so shocks the king, so traumatizes the king, he loses bowel controls and covers himself in feces, but that's actually what allows the guards to wait outside long enough to let Ehud escape. They wait outside until they're embarrassed. It's actually what buys him time to get away. And so here's what the Lord is doing. He doesn't appear in the text at all, like his name is not mentioned, but he is behind every detail. It's far too circumstantial to not be providential, all of these things working out. And what is the Lord doing? What is the Lord up to behind every scene and in every detail? He's redeeming his people. He's orchestrating this entire episode for the deliverance of his own. And yet, if you just read the words on the page, like we just did, you don't see him at all. He may seem absent to you. So let me ask this, like, rhetorical but logical question to you. If the Lord raised up Ehud, knowing that I'm going to use Ehud to deliver my people from the hand of the Moabites and Eglon, if the Lord does that in verse 15, and by verse 30 they are delivered, and the Lord knows that, is it possible to plan the ends of something and not plan the means of something? Can you be for sure how something is going to turn out if you don't plan every step of how it's going to go? You cannot plan the ends and not plan the means. That principle, that reality, is actually the entire book of Esther, where famously God is not mentioned. It's the only book in the Bible where God's name is not mentioned, and yet he's in every detail. How does Esther rise to power to save God's people and preserve a remnant, and the line of Judah and the line of Jesus stays intact, even though he's not mentioned? God is apparently silent, but he's not absent. That's what's going on here. God is orchestrating every detail of this story. That's why the narrator is going to such lengths to let you know all the details. Yes, there's some satire, and yes, there's some irony, but what he's saying is, hey, with this story does not happen unless the Lord is orchestrating this, and he's not even mentioned. It's been said before that God is always doing 10,000 things, and you may be aware of three of them. That's going on here. He's doing things that are undetected by the characters in the story, but what he's doing is he's orchestrating a redemption of his people. I'm always at work doing this, even if you don't see it. Even if my name's not mentioned, I'm actually orchestrating every detail. Why? To redeem and heal my people in the end. So let's make this a little personal. What do you do when God seems absent from the pages of your life? And maybe like the Israelites felt in verse 12, what do you do when he doesn't sometimes just seem absent, he seems to be against you? What do you do when he seems silent? And now be more honest, what do you think of him when you're in the chaos and he seems nowhere to be found? What do you think about him when those seasons happen? I know what I do. I write stories about him. I make a whole bunch of judgments about his character. And you can't make judgments about his character without also putting words in his mouth or thoughts in his heart about how he feels about you. So I make judgments about him. You must be doing this for that reason. You must have this. This must be what you're like. And if that's what you're like, I can tell you what you think about me then. And so when we're in that place, when we're writing stories about him, writing narratives about him, deciding that this must be what he's like and how he thinks about us, when we're in that place, what do we need? I can tell you what I typically think we think we need, or I think I need. I just need like a coffee date with the Lord. Can't meet at Portland Brew anymore, we'll meet at Frothy. And could you just tell me and explain what you're doing, please? Like, if you would just explain, you know, all that you're up to and kind of give me the full picture of what the lesson is you want me to learn, and like, just let me in on what you're doing. Explain to me, like, why you're letting this happen. Then I'll be okay. Would I? Because here's what that presumes. Let's say I get a coffee date with him. And we go to Frothy, and we sit down, and I go, hey, there's some pain, there's some darkness, there's a lot of fog right now, like I don't really know what's going on. I just need you to, like, teach me the lesson. Explain to me why you're letting this happen to me, and then I'll be okay. What happens if he does that, explains all that's going on, he unveils all of that to me? What if I don't approve of his reasons? Would it actually bring comfort to me? What if him explaining what he's up to doesn't bring me any comfort? And so the goal or comfort for us in these places when we feel like he's silent towards us is this will not bring you comfort. If the Lord's always doing 10,000 things and we're maybe aware of three of them, it would not bring you comfort. I promise you, if he sat down with you and explained to you all the other 9,997 things to you. That's the math of 10,000 minus 3, by the way. If he let you into all that, it wouldn't bring you comfort. And so maybe we set our heart's obsession in our pain on what we think we need from him. Maybe what we need is to trust that even when he seems silent, he's not absent. Maybe what we need to learn to believe is that even when we can't see him, he doesn't appear on the pages of our life, he is actually working every detail, orchestrating every part of the storyline to redeem us. And so maybe what we need in our pain, in our fog, is not that we need to know all that you're up to. Maybe we need the humility to be able to say, hey, I'm seeing my storyline. I have a perspective on my storyline. I have opinions about the way things are going in my life right now. And maybe I need the humility to say, my view of my storyline is not the only view there is. That from his vantage point, what he's always doing, what the 9,997 things are always about, always have the end purpose of saving, healing, and restoring me. Always. That's what he's always doing. But think about this now. In real time, if that's true, if he's always orchestrating in order to redeem, always, but I've got questions about the way that things are going in my life as a character in the story, the reality may be that my life feels excruciating, and to me it may feel like he's silent. It may even feel like he's strengthening my enemy against me. But that doesn't mean that's the only way to view it. He may actually be incredibly active, even though he feels incredibly silent. Like, what if God is busy coming after you, saving you, healing you, re-enchanting you, like re-colliding you with his beauty and with his magic of who he is and all of his mystery? What if he's actually re-enchanting your heart towards him, but what it feels like in the moment is that he's absent? And what if the way to get you to see that what he's always orchestrating is to re-enchant you with himself? And in order for you to get to see him that way and see your life from his perspective of what he's always up to, what if the way that you would get to that place is to give you something in your storyline that you would have never picked or asked for yourself? And so, like, apply that to all the tension points in your storyline. Every marital discord, every frustrating reality at your office, every romantic desire that's unfulfilled, every paycheck you wish were bigger, every co-write that's awkward, every relationship that's hard, every addiction you can't kick, every medical diagnosis that's incomplete or worse than the one before. What if all of those and 1,000 other places in your storyline were all just ways that the Lord was trying to get you to be quiet with him, so that you would slow down long enough to say, I'm viewing this darkness in my storyline a certain way. Will you let me see this storyline from your perspective? That I would trust in you, Lord, that you may appear silent, but that doesn't mean you are. And the interruptions and the darkness and the fog is actually how he's getting your attention. Is that possible? Is it possible that the way that you are viewing what's painful in your life is not the way that he's viewing it? And that even if you can't see from his perspective, would you dare to trust that he is actually orchestrating the details? Every last one of them. Why is he doing it? To redeem you, to re-enchant you, to heal you. That's actually what this story is showing you. The Lord seems silent, but he is not absent. What would it take for you to trust that? What would it take for you to believe that there's a God who may appear silent in certain seasons, but he actually isn't silent? He's not absent. He's not far from you. What would it take to believe that, like what we see in the story of Israel here with Ehud, the left-handed warrior from the right-handed tribe, and all the details that unfold, what would it take to believe that that storyline of God appearing silent but not being absent was not just true for them but true for you, like your story today? Well, here's where our confidence is in that viewpoint, is that no one knows that place, the pain of God's apparent silence but having to trust his providence. No one knows that pain more than Jesus. If you fast forward from Judges 1,000 or so years to the New Testament, you would find Jesus near the end of his earthly life on the night he was betrayed. He's instituted the Lord's Supper, which we'll celebrate here in a few minutes. And then he goes to the garden with his disciples and he asks them to stay awake and pray, and they can't do that. He's all alone in the garden. And he's in the Garden of Gethsemane, and he's not just about to face like his friend's betrayal and his friend's abandonment. He's about to face physical death. All that is real. What he's actually most anxious about is he's about to be separated from his Father for the first time since eternity past. It was a long time. He's never known existence separated from his Father. And he's dreading it. He's dreading the next step in this story. And he knows how the story ends. Like, he's God in the flesh. He knows how all this is going to work out. And that doesn't make his present tense pain in the garden any less excruciating. And so he pleads with the Father, Father, if there's any way for this cup of wrath, if there's any way for this cup to pass from me, let it be so. Not my wills, but yours be done. If there's any way for this to happen a different way, like, please let that be the case. If this storyline could play out in any different way, please let that happen. And his Father is silent. Not for us, like, apparently silent, like, actually silent. Like, he doesn't answer Jesus, which is the answer. Jesus, more than you and I will ever know, had to trust the providence of God in all things while he faced the silence of God in his pain. I want to stop here for just a minute before we close. We got about 30 or 40 more minutes. No, I'm kidding. I want to stop and ponder this for just a minute, okay? Like, learn from this moment of Jesus in the garden. Jesus in Gethsemane, God in the flesh, knows how the storyline is going to end. He knows Revelation 21 and 22, all things being made new, death will be no more. He knows all that. He also knows that in 3 days, resurrection will happen. Like, he's been predicting it all along. He knows that's coming. And yet, he's in the garden in agony, asking for a different way. So, like, apply this to you. Apply this to your own pain and your friends who are in pain. Take it from Jesus. It is possible to know how a story is going to end, and that will not make the pain of the present any less real. Do not think that just because you know how the story ends, you will not be in pain when you face darkness. It wasn't true for Jesus, who faced way deeper pain than you. It will not be true for you. But here's also what it means. Knowing how the story ends doesn't take the pain away, but here's what it does do. Learning to trust the providence of God when there's an apparent silence of God, take it from Jesus. If you know that this pain is not the end of the story, guess what it will allow you to do? Get up and face the pain. See, it is the only way that Jesus gets up from the garden and faces the darkness, because he knew, he was confident in the fact that the silence of God does not equal the absence of God. If you don't have that, believing that there's a bigger story going on in your pain, believing that your pain is not the end of the story, if you are not confident of that, you will not face the pain. You will numb it. You will avoid it. You will act like it's not there. You will do a whole bunch of things to medicate it. You will avoid anything that causes you suffering. You will not face the pain if you don't know that the providence of God is bigger than the apparent silence of God, and he's working all things to a better end to make sure your pain is not the end. If you don't have that confidence, you will not face the pain. But Jesus trusted it. And he gets up from the garden and he goes to face the wrath of God and drink the cup down to the bottom. He's like a sheep led to a slaughter, the Bible says. And then the Lamb of God hanging on a cross cries out to his Father that he had cried out to since eternity past. What does he hear? Nothing. My God, my God, why have you forsaken me? His Father was silent again with him. Again, not apparently silent, actually silent. The suffering of Jesus, if anyone had reason to get out, to hit eject, to say, I'm not going to do this, it was Jesus. He didn't deserve it. But he trusted that the providence of God was actually working all things in and through and above his pain to a better end. And so because Jesus did that for you, because Jesus did that for us, you can trust that the silence of God does not equal the absence of God in your life. And sometimes, that reality, because Jesus was abandoned by God, it means that you will never be, even when he appears silent. Because that is true, that sometimes is going to be all you've got to hold on to in the darkness. Sometimes it may be all that you have to cling to in the fog. The work of Jesus for you may be all you have to convince you that God is for you and not against you. And I know we're supposed to practice gratitude and like nature and family and friends in a city and like all and beautiful things, and we should practice gratitude and not complain. Here's what else I know. Sometimes in life, none of your life circumstances, like zero of them, no detail of your life will convince you that God is for you. None of them. But Jesus can. What Jesus has done for you can convince you that God is not against you and he is for you. If God does not spare his own son for you, that's what Romans chapter 8 says, God, who did not spare his own son for us, how much more will he not also graciously give us all things? Here's what Paul's saying in Romans 8. Your circumstances are going to tell you that God's against you, and you're going to have nothing to wage war with that taunt except what Jesus has done for you. Sometimes. He didn't spare his son for you. He is not against you. He didn't spare his son for you. He has not left you. You cannot hold up a circumstance of your life, as excruciating as they may be, you cannot hold that up to be greater proof of God's posture towards you than Jesus is. Nothing else may prove to you that God is working all things for your healing and redemption than the story of Jesus. Nothing may prove it to you, but Jesus can. And so the only way to keep believing that reality for my little story, like, God, you seem silent on this thing, and I'm pleading, and you seem to be against me, and where are you, and why are you not showing up in the way that I need you to show up on this part of my story? Where are you? You seem absent from the page. The only way to believe for my story that God is for me and not against me is to return again and again to the story of Jesus. Jesus proves to me that when God seems silent, he is not absent. So when I'm in pain, when I'm in the fog, when I'm in darkness, I don't need platitudes. I don't need Hallmark cards. I don't need to numb myself out. I don't need people to tell me that, hey, don't you know all this is going to be okay one day, so you shouldn't be in pain. No, I need to know that there's a God of providence. We confessed it together after the last worship song. What God's providence actually means is that nothing comes to me that doesn't go through his hands of providence. So I need to know that in his providence, I may be aware of 3 of the 10,000 things, but all 10,000 are working for my good. We need to see Jesus over and over to know that God is for us. So we're going to pray, and then we're going to sing, and then we'll come and feast on Jesus together to see just how much he is for us indeed. Let's pray. Jesus, many days you seem far off. And what we would love to conclude about the apparent silence of God is that it means you're absent as well. And so forgive us, one, Father, for what we've written about you in our hearts. You must view us this way, then, God, is what we want to say. But lift up our eyes, hold before our eyes the cross, where you experience the actual absence of God so that we wouldn't have to. Lift our eyes up, cup our faces, that we would see yours even when you seem silent, that we would dare to believe you are not absent, and that all 10,000 things are working for our reenchantment and our redemption. We ask all this in your name, Jesus. Amen.